This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Keri Phillips, and on this Rear Vision, Franco's body, the politics of the Spanish dictator's remains.
Franco must be exhumed because the Valley of the Fallen must become a memorial, a reminder for all those who suffered and gave their life to achieve something that today is being stolen from us.
Siendo él,
he was a dictator. I wouldn't even call him a person. He was a dictator and a criminal, and because of that, he shouldn't be in a public place.
Spaniards on the street telling Al Jazeera why they support the removal of the body of former Spanish dictator Francisco Franco from its original resting place, a massive state mausoleum in the mountains outside Madrid. On Thursday, his remains were exhumed and taken to a municipal cemetery. Franco, an ally of Hitler and Mussolini, remains a controversial figure in Spain. His reign lasted for almost 40 years, and he presided over both a brutal repression that led to the disappearance and death of thousands and an economic prosperity that transformed Spain. The exhumation of Franco's remains is the latest twist in the story of modern Spain, a story that begins with a military coup against a democratically elected progressive government in 1936. Dr. Jordi Cordelia teaches Hispanic studies at the University of Glasgow.
It was a military rebellion against a legitimate republican government that had been democratically elected by the Spanish people. The excuse was that law and order in Spain had collapsed. In reality, this was just an excuse. It was far from the truth. The thing is that the Republic was trying to implement a number of measures that were very progressive at the time. For instance, they tried to limit the influence of the church, they tried to improve education, they tried to improve the living and working conditions, and these basically provoked a reaction from the ruling classes who felt threatened by these progressive measures.
These reforms had been brought in with the Second Spanish Republic, proclaimed in 1931 after the abolition of the monarchy. Dr. Federico López Terra from Swansea University says the coup leaders expected to quickly seize power, but instead had set off a civil war that would last 3 years.
How the conflict unfolded? Well, at the beginning, they expected the coup to last a couple of days or weeks, but they didn't expect the resistance they were going to find basically in the cities. So they quickly managed in the first year to take most of the rural areas of Spain, where the Republicans secured the main cities and the East Coast. So the conflict unfolded like this for these years. We had two sides. On the one side, we had the nationalists, also called the rebels or the fascists, as their opponents were going to call them. And on the other side, we have the Republicans, also called the loyalists, the Popular Front, or the Reds, for communists, as the opponents were going to call them. Each side had the support of different international allies. Britain and France led a non-interventionist political alliance of 27 countries. The fascists were supported by Germany heavily, Italy and Portugal, while the Republicans were supported by Mexico and the Soviet Union, but also with the support with the international brigade. So even in countries that did not directly intervene in the conflict, many people, as the British people, intervened by joining these international brigades.
The whole country was affected by the war, and it was extremely violent because it was a civil war. So we had, you know, members of the same family fighting against each other. In terms of victims, overall, something like more than 300,000 people died as a direct consequence of the war. But then if we take into account starvation and illnesses right after the war, we are probably talking about more than 500,000 people died as a result of the war.
It was a war that drew in international participants too, didn't it?
That's true. Since the very beginning, it attracted international attention. Many young men from all over Europe and just all over the world traveled to Spain to fight, and their role was absolutely key. Some of them were experienced fighters, some others not, but they were really motivated, and their intention was, of course, support. It was to support the Republic, and to try to stop fascism. In a way, many saw the Spanish Civil War as the start of what would be a conflict between democracy and fascism. And of course, like fascism was already important in other European countries such as Germany and Italy. So that's why, for example, many Italian men or German men also traveled to Spain to fight, but also from the UK, France, the US and several other countries. So it had an international dimension since the very beginning.
I think it's important also to understand the figure of Franco.
Stephen Forti is a historian at the Autonomous University of Barcelona.
That was quite different from Mussolini and Hitler. Franco was not a political leader at the beginning of the century, in the 20s, in the 30s. He was a military general. He called himself Generalissimo, big general. He was born in Galicia, in the northwest of Spain, at the end of the 19th century. He was really important for Franco, the experience in the colonialist war in Morocco in the 20s. And obviously, after the victory in the Spanish Civil War, he was the dictator of the new states that had Mussolini Italy as a model, was one-party regime with Falange and Movimiento Nacional. And after the war, but also during the war, there was a strong repression of Republican people that only defend the legal and legitimate government of the Second Republic.
The civil war finished with Franco's victory, but that didn't mean an end to the violence.
No, the violence didn't stop after the civil war. The figures of people who died in the civil war are estimated between 250,000 and 1 million dead people. That's just during the civil war. But after the civil war, Franco's rule, his dictatorship, is normally divided in several stages. The first one being early Francoism, more or less until the 50s, mid-50s, and it was characterized what historians called white terror. Basically, was very harsh reprisal against the enemies of the country, mass executions, hundreds of thousands fleeing the country. And then we have the guerrilla warfare, the Spanish maquis, as they were called, who still resisted mainly in the north of Spain, in the mountains, until the 50s. So repression went on quite heavily until the late 50s in Spain.
I think it's important to say that Franco continued to repress the population right until his death in 1975.
Dr. Georgina Blakely from the University of Huddersfield.
And the historian Paul Preston has written a book called The Spanish Holocaust, and he deliberately chose that title to really emphasize the extent to which Franco carried out a state policy of extermination, of terror on those who fought on the losing side. In February of 1939, they passed what was called the Law of Political Responsibility, which made anyone who had supported in any way, often by not doing anything, who supported in any way the Republican side. And that allowed the general population to denounce neighbours, anyone who they regarded as slightly suspicious of being on the Republican side. And that led to a huge policy of the population being complicit in this policy of terror. And of course, the implications of that for the kind of transition, for the way in which the past was handled in Spain, was enormous.
Although the violence and repression didn't end, it became less intense after the end of World War II.
Well, the situation calmed down a little bit for a very specific reason. Germany and Italy were defeated in World War II. So World War II ended, and Germany and Italy were the natural allies of Franco, of course. So when fascism was defeated all over Europe, it became clear to Franco and his government that unless Spain changed a little bit, their regime wouldn't last long, because the allies would also intervene in Spain. And for a while, in 1945, there was, well, a threat for Franco's regime, of course, that the allies would decide to overthrow the dictator. And it could have happened. It didn't, because of the Cold War. The threat now was communism. So having a dictatorship in Spain, of course, it was not ideal, but Franco was seen as a remnant of the past, somebody who shouldn't be there, but that's why the regime survived, actually, because of this opposition between European democracies and the Soviet Union.
From the 50s on, from the late 50s on, is the second stage of Francoism, which is heavily characterized for this aim to internationalize Spain, to open it to new markets, also to develop the economy. Of course, the main purpose was to cling the image of the country, but also to recover the economy. In the 50s is when Franco is going to transfer power from the fascists and somehow is going to marginalize the fascists in the government and give more powers to the technocrats of the Opus Dei in order for them to take on these economic reforms that were considered to be, and they were called an economic, Spanish economic miracle. But it was heavily based on the third sector, tourism, which meant not only open the country to new markets economically, but also indirectly culturally as well. So in this period, it has also been characterized for this openness into new Spanish stereotypes. The Minister of Tourism and Information, Manuel Fraga, was in charge of a very popular campaign to promote Spain in the world and tourism in Spain called Spain is Different, which would be posters promoting different stereotypes of typical Spain, you know, flamenco and bullfighting and all this kind of stuff. In a way, simplifying very much what the image of Spain was, but to a certain degree, Franco understood that he couldn't just play with military power. He had also had to play with soft power, so selling the image of an open Spain, a modern Spain, and a Spain that was different, actually.
Spain opened further to modern influences throughout the 1960s. Dr. Caroline Gray, a Spanish expert from Aston University.
The dictatorship remained the same in the sense of culturally, in the sense of the importance of religion in society, in the sense of the fact that the Spanish right-wing views dominated. But there was, towards the end of the dictatorship, the 1960s, Spain did start to undergo a process more of economic modernization due to, you know, outside influence, that there was more of a beginnings of modernization. I mean, it got to the stage where some more reforming factions within the Francoist side started to take more control within the government because basically the country needed it. I mean, poverty was so extreme by the 1960s that even within the Francoist side, some more reforming factions realised that there needed to be a level of change. So Spain did in the 1960s start to modernise a bit economically. And that did actually start to pave the way for within society, people starting to realise that there was perhaps an alternative. And I think that helped then when Spain did transition to democracy.
This is Rear Vision with Keri Phillips on Radio National, RN. On this Rear Vision, Franco's body, the politics of the Spanish dictator's remains.
Franco ha muerto.
Those three words in the early hours of the 20th of November 1975 marked the passing into history of one of the most controversial figures of the 20th century, the Caudillo, Generalissimo Francisco Franco, who'd ruled Spain for 40 years.
The tough old dictator finally gave up his amazing struggle to live at 4:40 a.m. local time. The Spanish nation told that the man who had ruled them with an iron fist for 36 years was dead in a news flash broadcast on the state-controlled radio an hour and a half later.
He died in 1975 because he was already very, very old. I don't remember exactly his age, but he must have been 80 plus. He was kind of expected in the country. The country had been changing quite a lot in the 1970s because of this, because the dictator was already quite old and out of touch with society, really. Franco was a man that really didn't understand the changes that took place in Europe from the 1950s onwards, right? The economy changed, society changed, culture changed, and he was always a man of the early 20th century. What happened immediately after was a period of transition called precisely the Spanish transition, which lasted five years. During these few years, a group of lawyers drafted a new constitution, which then was approved by the people. and there was a democratic election. Of course, during the transition, political parties became legal again. There was freedom of press. So there was an explosion of freedom between 1975 and the early 80s, basically. So the situation in Spain changed a lot and very, very fast because the country had to catch up with modernity and become a fully democratic, egalitarian European country.
Franco had anointed Juan Carlos, the grandson of the last king of Spain, as his successor. But after the dictator's death, Juan Carlos led the move to democracy, ultimately becoming king in a restored constitutional monarchy. Spain's fragile new democracy, facing the possibility of another military coup, closed the door on its immediate violent past with a pact of silence.
It wasn't a transition where the Francoist side who had committed atrocities were punished and jailed for their crimes. That's not the way the transition took place. There was a pact of silence, as it were, as it's become known, whereby it was agreed to let bygones be bygones, to let the past be the past. The centrist party that took charge of the transition, they really were reformist sections from within the Francoists. And so Francoists who had committed crimes were not punished at that stage. An agreement was made to let bygones be bygones. And I think we have to think that much as with hindsight, people now are often looking back on that and saying, you know, well, maybe this wasn't right. People should have been tried for their crimes. I think we have to think of what was actually feasible at that stage. You know, you're in a case where the military is still very strong. The military was associated with Franco and they were very reluctant towards this change.
Meanwhile, what had happened to Franco's body?
Well, that's very interesting because he was buried in El Valle de los Caídos, the Valley of the Fallen. But he never expressed, at least in writing, his interest in being buried there. It seems that it was a rushed decision by the government, really, that they had to find a place to bury Franco. And this place needed to have, of course, some kind of symbolic importance, because after all, he had been the dictator for almost 40 years.
Can you give us some idea of what this place is like, the Valley of the Fallen? It's a complex, is it?
Yes, it's a massive complex, colossal complex. It's an enormous area. There's a massive portico with a really big plaza in the center. There's then, of course, the basilica, which was excavated in the rock. It's in a mountain. And on top of it, there's an enormous cross, like 150 meters cross. So it's a really spectacular place. Quite sinister, though. Very sinister place, of course, because of what happened there and who built it. Political prisoners, basically.
Who else is buried there? It's not just Franco, is it?
No, there's almost 24,000 people, including soldiers who fought for Franco, but also Republican soldiers who fought against Franco. What happened in the valley is very surprising. They started building it in 1940, and it finished in 1958, right? And in 1958, they decided to change a little bit the meaning of the site, transform it into a monument symbolizing the reconciliation of the country. This was the idea. And in order to achieve this goal, they started exhuming human remains from several mass graves all over the country, all over Spain, in order to move these remains to the valley and bury them there. That's why there's a combination of soldiers who died fighting for Franco, but also Republicans, right? Those remains taken from, as I said, some say that more than 400 mass graves all over Spain, the families of those who had been buried in these graves were never asked permission, basically, or were not even told that their relatives had been moved to the Valley of the Fallen. There's almost 28,000 bodies buried there, the remains of 28,000 people, many of them unidentified. We don't know who they are. We don't know where they came from.
The Valley of the Fallen, built with the labour of political prisoners and containing the unidentified remains of thousands of Franco's victims, became both a popular tourist destination and a mecca for the extreme right.
The Valley of the Fallen is visited by two groups of people generally. On the one hand, it's visited by tourists who often don't understand the significance of what it is they're seeing. And on the other hand, until the historical memory law in 2007, it was visited by people on the extreme right who would go and pay homage to Franco, especially, for example, on the anniversary of his death on the 20th of November. But since 2007 and the passing of the historical memory law, acts of homage, political acts in general, are banned at the site of the Valley of the Fallen. The historical memory law in 2007 was a long time coming because the issue of dealing with the past, the issue of transitional justice, was never dealt with at the time of the Spanish transition. But that doesn't mean that there was a collective forgetting. But it took until really the beginning of the 2000s that people began to start to talk about the past again and to try and deal with the past. It's important to remember that it's estimated that there are around 30,000 bodies littered literally across the Spanish countryside in mass graves, 30,000 people whose bodies have not been exhumed, have not been identified, who have not been given a dignified burial. And so the 2007 historical memory law comes about as a result of really a social movement of organisations that began to address the question of the past, and in particular began to locate the bodies of the Republican dead who had not been exhumed prior to that point. So the 2007 law, proposed by the socialist government at the time, led to a public recognition of the past. It contains articles that require street names, public symbols to do with Francoism to be removed. And it also contained an article which banned acts of homage at the Valley of the Fallen. But many were disappointed at the time that it didn't take the bolder step of turning the Valley of the Fallen into an educational centre that would really teach both Spanish and foreigners about the horrors of the Civil War and the long dictatorship that followed.
The socialist government responsible for the Historical Memory Act also set up a committee to look into the future of the Valley of the Fallen in 2011. It recommended the removal of Franco's remains.
It's something really, really peculiar in the war, not only in Europe, that 40 years after the end of a dictatorship, the dictator had like a complex, not only to remember the war, not only to remember his figure, but to celebrate his figure. It's something completely impossible to understand in Germany, for example. Do you can understand that in Germany there is a complex built by Hitler, where Hitler is buried there, is completely impossible to understand. So I think that the decision that the Spanish government take in the last month to put Franco's remain in a private grave and change also the signification, or try to change the signification of the Valley of Fallen Complex, is something necessary. And it's really important also for the memory of the past in Spain that they decided to make it.
Changes of government and legal action taken by Franco's family delayed the exhumation, but last week Franco's remains were interred in the family mausoleum in Madrid.
It is controversial what's going to happen, both with the valet and with Franco's remains, the other issue being wherever Franco's body goes, it can become a new centre of pilgrimage for the fascist. At the beginning, the family, actually, the family, Franco's family, decided when he was given the order to exhume the body, decided to take Franco's body to the Cathedral of the Almudena in the centre of Madrid, because they have a family crypt there. Obviously, the government opposed to that for security reasons, and because they obviously didn't want to have in the main center of Madrid a center of pilgrimage for fascists. So now they're going to take Franco's remains to El Prado, where the family has a grave there, and he's going to be buried with Carmen Polo, his wife. So who knows if now El Prado is going to become a center of pilgrimage. Maybe, but it's definitely not an obvious place for it to be, let's say.
Spain's ruling socialists have claimed victory but fallen short of a majority in the country's most divisive elections in decades. The far-right party Vox is set to enter parliament for the first time since military rule ended in the 1970s.
Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, unable to pass his budget through the parliament, was forced to bring on another poll.
The only thing that I ask Spaniards is to send a clear message for stability.
The once two main parties have splintered into five.
It's a time of political uncertainty in Spain. The recent sentencing of nine Catalan independence leaders over the unauthorised referendum in 2017 sparked large street protests in Barcelona last week. Spanish voters are about to take part in national elections, the fourth in 4 years, after elections in April failed to produce a government. Will the exhumation of Franco be an issue in the campaign?
It's a really interesting question, and it's not easy to answer. In Spain now we are in a complex situation because we vote 6 months ago, and the Socialist Party was not be able to find allied in the parliament to form a government, to create a government. So there is a new election, and Franco's remain really present in the debate, in the public opinion, in the television debate and so on, and also in the bars, in the streets. But I think that the most important question in the next election will be the Catalan crisis, because in the last days there is a big crisis another time in Catalonia after the sentence of a constitutional court against the political Catalan leaders. So I think that the election, the most important point will be Catalonia another time.
Nonetheless, Spain's fascist past remains a live issue for many Spaniards.
The past is still a current issue for many people in Spain, particularly the grandchildren of those who were repressed, those who were killed, those who were tortured. And it's really the grandchildren that have led this social movement to recover the bodies of the Republican dead and to deal with the past in Spain. And they felt very frustrated by the fact that the state in Spain has really dragged its feet on many of these issues. But for those people in particular, it still has huge significance. The past in Spain, because it hasn't been dealt with, for example, by a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, also tends to frame what happens in the present. So, for example, the current situation in Catalonia with the political prisoners tends to be framed by the past and by tropes that have been used in the past. So in that way, the past really does colour the present in Spain.
Dr. Georgina Blakely, Director of Teaching and Learning at the University of Huddersfield. The other guests were Dr. Federico Lopez Terra, a senior lecturer in Hispanic Studies at Swansea University, Dr. Jordi Cornelia from the School of Modern Languages and Cultures at the University of Glasgow, Dr. Caroline Gray, lecturer in politics and Spanish at Aston University in the UK, and Associate Professor Stephen Forty, a historian from the Autonomous University of Barcelona. Isabella Tropiano is the sound engineer for this Rear Vision. Bye from Keri Phillips.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.